today is August 18th, 2012. Okay, we've been studying over the past few weeks Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 77. This is called the Greater or Longer Discourse to Sakaludayi, Maha Sakaludayi Sutta. And the theme of this sutta is the reasons why the Buddha's disciples have respect for him and live in dependence on him. And first the Buddha had asked Sakaludayi that question, what his opinion was. And Sakaludayi mentioned 5 ascetic characteristics. But the Buddha then explained that if his disciples were venerating him because of these ascetic practices, then they should have more veneration for some of the other disciples rather than the Buddha, because these disciples practiced these ascetic qualities more vigorously than the Buddha did. And so then the Buddha mentions the real reasons why his disciples respect and revere him. And we went through several of these, and we came to the section, this is on page 6, to put on 636. It's the section called The Way to Develop Wholesome Qualities. And in this section, the Buddha mentions the first set of wholesome qualities that the Buddha mentions are those which are come to be called the 37 aids to enlightenment, the Bodhipakkhya Dhammas. And these are 37 qualities that are collected into 7 sets, 7 groups. And we went through the 4 foundations of mindfulness, the 4 right kinds of striving, or the 4 right efforts, the 4 bases for spiritual power, the 5 faculties, and the 5 powers. Okay, and so now we come to the 6th group of these sets, and this is called, these are called the 7 enlightenment factors, the 7 bodhicittas. The word bodhicitta, it's a compound. The compound of the first part is bodhi, which means enlightenment or awakening, and then anga, which means factor. But in Pali, when you have the dhi joining with an a, in order to make the sound smoother, the dhi turns into jjh, so it becomes bodhicitta. And here we have 7 mental factors, which are called bodhicittas. So we could just first read through the passage, then I'll give explanation of it. So the Buddha is speaking to Udayi, and he says, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the 7 enlightenment factors. And here a bhikkhu develops the mindfulness enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and results in relinquishment. Then he develops the investigation of states, or the investigation of dharmas, phenomena enlightenment factor, the energy enlightenment factor, the rapture enlightenment factor, the tranquility enlightenment factor, the concentration enlightenment factor, the equanimity enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and results in relinquishment. So that descriptive phrase, supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and resulting in relinquishment, that goes together with each of the enlightenment factors. And so if we just take the seven enlightenment factors themselves, just as abstract qualities, their mindfulness, investigation, energy, rapture, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. But it seems to me that the seven enlightenment factors are not just ordinary mindfulness or ordinary joy, ordinary energy, but when we call these qualities enlightenment factors, the way I see it, it implies that they've already acquired a certain degree of strength, a certain degree of intensity, a certain degree of maturity, so that we could say that they are definitely moving in the direction of awakening. You know, when we practice in our day-to-day life or our daily meditation practice, we try to cultivate mindfulness. We could say that this is the seed of the enlightenment factor of mindfulness. So we're cultivating, like growing a tree or a flower. You know, when you plant the seeds of the flower and then you're giving them water every day, maybe putting some fertilizer into the soil to help the flowers grow. In a way, you could say you're growing a flower, but until the stem actually comes above the surface and the flower is starting to appear, the bud of the flower is starting to appear, it's only at that point that you could really say that you're growing flowers, you know, in a very literal sense. So it's like this with the bojangas or enlightenment factors. You know, whenever we practice mindfulness, effort, investigation, and so on, we're creating, or let's say we're cultivating the seeds of the enlightenment factors, but it's only when these factors become strong and dominant forces within the mind that they really become, in the proper sense, enlightenment factors. And I think it's to underscore that point that the Buddha, and we find this repeatedly in the texts when the enlightenment factors are described, very, very often they have this descriptive phrase attached to them. So it's said that they are supported by or based upon seclusion, dispassion, and cessation. And Pali, this is Viveka, Nisita, and it's there's a rather technical way to explain these descriptive terms in the commentary, but we don't have to go into all of the technicalities. But what it basically means is that each of these factors is developed in the sense that it's, first, it's based on the, you could say, the aspiration or the inclination of the mind towards Nibbana. So it's really Nibbana that's being indicated by each of these terms. Viveka. Viveka means is translated seclusion. We could say is the seclusion from all of the defilements of the mind. So separating the mind from its defilements. Dispassion, viraga, means the ending of attachment, passion, lust, clinging, and so on. And cessation will be the cessation of craving, the cessation of suffering. And then it's each of these factors is maturing towards relinquishment, the giving up of, you could say, all of the defilements, all of the clinging to the bases of birth and death, of samsara. And it's interesting that the enlightenment factors are laid out here in a particular order. And so the question comes up, you know, is there any specific strategy or design within the sequence in which the Buddha has laid them out? Now, I think that there is, and to show that there is, I want just to refer to another sutta that comes later in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing. It's number 118, and the passage I have in mind starts on page 946. So if you have the book, you can keep your place marked for sutta number 77, but just jump ahead to page 946. And we'll see how these enlightenment factors unfold in sequence, in a meaningful sequence. Here the Buddha is speaking about mindfulness of, first he's spoken about mindfulness of breathing, and then he's explained how the development through the 16 phases or 16 aspects of mindfulness of breathing brings about the development of the four satipatthanas, the four foundations of mindfulness. And now he's going to explain how developing the four foundations of mindfulness brings about the development of the seven enlightenment factors. So he says, if you don't have the book, don't worry, because I'm going to read the passage. So he says, how do the four foundations of mindfulness developed and cultivated fulfill these seven enlightenment factors? And you see, it's when the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, you know, not just at the beginning stage, but when those four foundations of mindfulness gain some potency, some strength through practice, that they start to activate these seven enlightenment factors. Okay, so then he says, whenever a monk abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world, on that occasion, unremitting mindfulness is established in him. Then whenever unremitting mindfulness is established in that monk, on that occasion, the mindfulness enlightenment factor is aroused in him, and he develops it, and by development, it comes to fulfillment in him. Okay, so by developing or practicing the four satipatthanas, in this case, the first one, contemplation of the body, it's when that mindfulness becomes unremitting, it becomes strong, persistent, continuous, then we can say that the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is aroused in him. There are actually three stages indicated in this simple sentence. First, on that occasion, the mindfulness enlightenment factor is aroused, you could say, or it's started, it's instigated by him. Once it's instigated, he develops it. That's the second stage. It comes up, he develops it, and then the third stage, by development, it comes to fulfillment. That is, it reaches maturity. Okay, now as he is cultivating the mindfulness enlightenment factor, then at a certain point when the mindfulness becomes well established, then it says he investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it. I think what that state, or tang dhammang is in the Pali, what he's investigating, the way I would understand it, would be whatever particular quality of mind or state of mind has arisen, he's looking into that state of mind, looking into those factors of mind. Because what the investigation factor is doing is distinguishing what are the wholesome states of mind that arise, what are the unwholesome states that arise. So it has to be able to make that distinction and to remove, to put away the unwholesome states and to strengthen the wholesome states. Is the video playing? Is the video on?
The video is on, but no sound.
Oh. Can you tell now whether there's sound? Is there sound then? Is it going? What has to be done to make it go? That wasn't my voice, was it?
Don't be scared, Mara.
Okay, maybe I just have to continue otherwise. Yeah. It's being recorded on the...
It's being recorded.
Oh, the sound is being recorded too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, okay. Okay, so now, with mindfulness well established, he goes into investigation and examining that state. I would say that's whatever state has arisen, whatever dhammas or mental factors have arisen. Okay, so as he is investigating and examining that state with wisdom, inquiring into it, on that occasion, again, the investigation of dhammas, enlightenment factor, is aroused, he develops it, it comes to fulfillment. Okay, now we come to the third enlightenment factor. So while he's investigating and examining that state with wisdom, then tireless energy is aroused. So you can see that it's the investigation with wisdom that brings up, that activates, that arouses, that instigates the energy. So now this is, I would say that this is not just the ordinary factor of mental effort, but this is energy where it really becomes strong and powerful. I think this is why energy comes in the third place, which seems rather unusual. Usually we think, say, in terms if we take the five spiritual faculties, we have faith, then energy, then mindfulness, then concentration, then wisdom. So there we have energy in the second position, and energy interacts with, or energy works together, collaborates with mindfulness to bring about concentration and wisdom. But here we have mindfulness first, then investigation, which is the work of wisdom, giving rise to energy. So that suggests that this is a very potent energy, what the text calls tireless or unremitting energy. Okay, then he develops and cultivates that energy. As he's doing so, what is called unworldly, or maybe better to call it spiritual rapture, arises. The reason why it's called Nihramisa, which means, it was translated unworldly, non-carnal, or spiritual rapture, is because ordinary people will experience this piti or joy just from ordinary worldly pleasures. But this isn't the kind of rapture or joy that arises from just ordinary blissful experiences. But this is a rapture that arises through the collaboration, you could say, of mindfulness, investigation, and energy. As one is working, making the effort to remove those unwholesome states, to strengthen, to reinforce the wholesome states, at times there will arise this kind of uplifting bliss, a rapture which pervades first the mind, and then it seems to spill over from the mind through the whole body. And it's a kind of rapture that's very, very different from the enjoyment that we have from indulging the pleasures of the senses. So it's called non-cardinal or unworldly joy. It's like the mind is sort of bright and sparkling and luminous. But then this rapture, as it initially comes up, it has a kind of ecstatic feeling to it, an ecstatic tone, which initially it's very, very blissful, but that becomes an object of attachment. And so in order to mature it, one has to allow that rapture to reach a kind of peak, then settle down and come to a plateau where it can be sustained, but it's not turning into a distraction or a disturbance to the meditation. And so that is called the stage where, in one who is rapturous, the body and the mind become tranquil. So this is the arising of the fourth enlightenment factor, the enlightenment factor of tranquility. Okay, as the mind settles and becomes tranquil, body and mind become tranquil, then the text, I'm in paragraph 35, in one whose body is tranquil, and who feels pleasure. Pleasure here is sukha, which is not mentioned on its own as an enlightenment factor, but it seems that this pleasure or happiness arises through tranquility. And the pleasure, it's different from rapture. Rapture has a kind of exuberance to it, an excitement, a little bit of a stimulating quality, whereas the pleasure is a quieter, calmer feeling. And then it's through the intensification of that pleasant feeling that the mind becomes more and more settled and absorbed in its object. And so in one whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, the mind becomes samahitank, becomes concentrated. Or actually, I think it's samadhiyati, chittang samadhiyati. The mind becomes concentrated. And that becoming concentrated, that implies the presence of the concentration factor of enlightenment. That's the samadhi bodhicitta, the factor of concentration, the mind focused continuously, uninterruptedly on its object. Okay, and then as the mind becomes increasingly concentrated, it settles down more and more steadily onto its object, and all of the tendencies towards excitement on the one hand and dejection on the other, all of those become smoothed out, and so the mind enters into a state called equanimity. And so it says that he looks on with equanimity at the mind thus concentrated. On whatever occasion a bhikkhu closely looks with equanimity at the mind thus concentrated, on that occasion the equanimity enlightenment factor is aroused in him. Then he develops it, and by developing it, it comes to fulfillment in him. Okay, so we have here seven enlightenment factors. And in a sutta that comes in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha divides these seven enlightenment factors into two classes, two groups. One of them is the group, we could say it's the stimulating group of enlightenment factors. The other is the set of tranquilizing enlightenment factors. So let's go through them and see. Maybe we could try to figure out which factors belong in which category. Okay, first we take the stimulating or arousing enlightenment factors. Anybody want to guess which factors will belong in that group? Do we have the mobile microphone? Okay, maybe pass that back.
I think investigation, you said it was work. You said it was the work of wisdom, so that sounds applicable.
Yeah, okay, good.
And energy, of course.
Yeah.
And
good, very good, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Okay, very good. And now we have the tranquilizing enlightenment factors. Anybody want to take a stab at that? Maybe stab isn't a good word to use for certainly, we can get the first one, the tranquilizing enlightenment factors.
Tranquility?
Yeah.
Situation, economy?
Right, right. Okay, so we have three: stimulating or arousing enlightenment factors, three tranquilizing enlightenment factors. So we have six enlightenment factors. And there's one more enlightenment factor. What is that one? Where does that belong?
Investigation?
No, we have investigation in the stimulating factors.
Yeah,
and where does mindfulness go? Speaking to, did you have the microphone? Oh, I thought you had the microphone, I'm sorry. Actually, very good. I mean, you're definitely on the right track, but it's actually said that mindfulness doesn't actually belong to either of the two categories, but mindfulness is what is responsible for overseeing them so that one can achieve balance between the two groups. Because sometimes if one puts too much emphasis on the stimulating or arousing enlightenment factors, then the mind, you know, it's good if you develop them to an extent, but if they're not balanced with the tranquilizing factors, then the mind becomes overexcited, and then it can get distracted, disturbed, restless. And if one puts too much emphasis on the tranquilizing factors without enough emphasis, without balancing them by the stimulating factors, then what happens? Mind becomes tranquil, tranquil, tranquil. Oh, everything is so fine. So one tends to, the mind becomes drowsy and sluggish, can fall asleep. So mindfulness has to sort of keep a watch on the mind. And if one sees too much excitement, too much stimulation, bring the mind down to tranquility. Too much tranquility, then one has to do something to arouse the mind. So the Buddha, he uses, to illustrate this process, he uses a simile about somebody who wants to make a fire, and he wants to get the fire to burn evenly. So if he's building up the fire, initially he has to start by putting, say, leaves, and in our time we would use pieces of paper, wooden chips. But if the fire is blazing up nicely, and he just keeps on adding wooden chips and logs and pieces of leaves to it, and maybe sprinkling the gasoline onto the fire, what's going to happen to the fire? It'll just blaze up and get out of control. So when the fire is getting too big, too powerful, then he has to sprinkle water on it and maybe throw some sand on it, and that will make the fire settle down. So this is like when one is developing the stimulating or arousing factors. If the mind is too excited, then one has to calm it down through the tranquilizing factors. That's like putting the sand or the wet leaves onto the fire.
Then why are they in the order that they're in with the three arousing factors coming before?
Wait, take the microphone.
Yeah. Why then are they?
But just, if it's not working, just speak with a loud voice.
Yeah, why are they in the order that they're in then, with the three arousing factors coming before the three tranquilizing ones, if the tranquilizing ones are to be applied, you know, in order to make the arousing ones more subtle and pliable? And,
okay, what I would say is that initially one has to develop the arousing factors, because sort of the natural tendency of the mind is to remain rather passive. And so I would say, or to remain in its familiar grooves. So one has to develop those arousing factors to activate the mind, to sort of almost to push it into the meditative state, but in the direction of the meditative state. But then, in order to really enter properly into the meditative state, then one has to develop those factors which will settle the mind and make it calm and more quiescent.
But does what you were just saying before then, does that mean that in actual practice,
yep,
that is, one might not go in just that order, but one might start using the tranquilizing factors earlier in the sequence?
Yeah. It's initially, it seems to me that one has to use the arousing or stimulating factors first in order to to get the ball rolling.
Yeah.
But then sometimes the ball might be rolling a bit too quickly.
Yeah.
Then one has to use the tranquilizing factors to settle it down. Sometimes once it settles down, then it might start rolling too slowly. Then one has to use the simulating factors to make it roll more quickly.
But we also seem to be talking now as if this were a matter of something that's really in control of the will, where he doesn't seem actually to be wording things that way. He seems to be saying, well, if you do the one thing, then the next thing arises, as though it's something like it. So that there is the order really isn't optional as he's thinking about it. He thinks it will sort of naturally create itself that way. Does something like that?
Okay, I understand your question. What I would say is that the order that they're set out here is, I would call this an ideal order.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean that in actual practice one is always moving according to the ideal order, because people's minds work differently.
Okay.
And that even the same mind works differently on different occasions. Okay. So one has to judge from the situation what is the appropriate remedy to apply to a mind which is not moving along the right track.
Okay.
I just wanted to finish the simile of the fire and the leaves before the fire and the fuel before we go further. Okay, so one case when initially one starts the fire with a flame, with the pieces of paper, chips of wood, dry leaves, till the fire is blazing, then one has to make it tranquilize it, or reduce the intensity of the fire by putting into it some sand or sprinkling it with water to make it settle down a little bit. Okay, then there are occasions when maybe that covered it. It starts the fire. Oh yeah, then when the fire is, if one puts the sand, the wet leaves, the water onto the fire, and it diminishes, but then it's starting to diminish too much, then you have to feed the fire with more fuel to make it blaze up again. So then one puts into the fire, one puts more chips, wooden chips, more dry leaves, more pieces of paper, till the fire will start blazing again. And so one has to balance between the feeding the fire and quenching the fire, or quelling the fire, in order to get the fire at a proper level of intensity. Okay.
The word sukha, when I read it in Sanskrit, it's often translated as comfort or an ease.
It has quite a number of implications,
okay,
or connotations.
In Pali, I generally see people translate it pleasure.
Well, you see, because it's used in Pali often to designate a particular kind of feeling. So the two primary types of feeling are dukkha vedana, which is painful feeling, and then the opposite of that is sukha vedana, which is pleasant feeling. But in Pali too, sukha can be used to mean comfort, to mean ease, to mean happiness as a persisting quality, rather than a particular kind of feeling. Okay, any questions now? Any further questions on the seven factors of enlightenment? Okay, so now we'll go on. Amongst the aids to enlightenment that the Buddha is speaking about, we come to the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is the last group of factors in the 37 aids to enlightenment. So the Buddha says, again, Udayi, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, and what is this? It's simply here a bhikkhu, a monk, it's really anybody, develops right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Okay, here what we speak of as the Noble Eightfold Path is actually a set of eight factors which join together to become like the primary drivers of the practice. And it seems of all of the different sets of factors that the Buddha mentioned as aids to enlightenment, the one which has received the most attention in his teaching is the Noble Eightfold Path. So we see in the Buddha's first discourse, the practice that he teaches is the Noble Eightfold Path. And now through his entire ministry, teaching career, he always emphasizes again and again the Noble Eightfold Path. And here, what's interesting is that there seems to be changes in the sequence from the seven enlightenment factors. So you could see within different groups, different factors, which might be the same technically from one group to the other, are put in different positions, maybe because they're playing different roles within those groups. So here we start off with right view. And elsewhere, right view is explained or defined in terms of panya, which means wisdom. And so at the very beginning of the path, one has wisdom coming. Why is that? Usually we say, when we speak about the three stages of training, we speak about sila, or virtuous conduct, samadhi, concentration, mental tranquility, and wisdom. So wisdom comes third after concentration and virtuous conduct. Yet here we have right view, which is understanding equated with wisdom, coming at the beginning. What could be the reason for that? Judy, is that your name?
Yes, Judy.
Okay. It's good to take the microphone, so.
I think it's having to do with understanding the presence of suffering, that there's suffering.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is good, yeah. Anybody want to add anything to that? We should mention that the right view in the text that's repeatedly defined as understanding the Four Noble Truths. So anybody have any comment to make on that? Any thoughts why it should be put at the very beginning of the path?
It's a base that conditions everything else that comes after it.
Yeah, that's. I think that's basically the reason. That it's the right view, which I say that it is the eye of the path. It sort of shows the nature of existence, the real nature of life, of existence, which forms the basis for the whole practice. So the right view, which comes at the beginning of the path, I would say, is not the penetrative wisdom. It's not the direct insight. That can only come after concentration. But to start the path, one needs what I call a conceptual understanding of these truths, of the Four Noble Truths. And among the Four Noble Truths is the Eightfold Path. So in order to practice the path, one has to have some understanding of the path. What is the path? What is the purpose? What is the framework within which the path is laid out and is moving? So is that right view, understanding the nature of suffering, understanding that suffering arises from craving and other defilements, understanding that by ending our craving and defilements we can be free from suffering, and understanding that the Eightfold Path is the way to the end of suffering. With that understanding, then one can develop the other factors of the path, and they, based on that understanding, all the other factors will then become part of the way leading to the end of suffering. Okay, so from right view, there comes the next factor of the path. This is called right intention, right purpose, right motivation. And the way right intention is always defined in the text, it's the intention towards desirelessness or non-sensuality, the intention of non-ill will, that sounds rather awkward, the intention of benevolence, of goodwill, of kindness towards others, and the intention of harmlessness, the intention not to inflict harm and suffering and injury on others. So the way I see it, that through right view, one gets the accurate, precise understanding of the nature of existence, and then based on that understanding, our volition changes, our intentions change, so that we see that it's craving that brings suffering to ourselves, so we have the intention of overcoming craving. That is the intention of desirelessness, of the intention of renunciation, of relinquishment. And then, again, through right view, we see that all other living beings are also subject to suffering. So based on that insight, then we develop the intention not to inflict harm and suffering on others. So that accounts for the intention of goodwill, to regard others with thoughts of kindness, of helpfulness, and the intention of non-injury, not to inflict harm and suffering on others. And so right view and right intentions, those two factors I see as being the forerunners of the Noble Eightfold Path. They're the kind of guides. Right view is the intellectual guide in the sense of what gives us the right understanding component, and right intention is more the guide in the engaged aspect of the mind. What gives us the right motivation, the proper motivation. Then with that proper motivation, then one undertakes initially the three factors that belong to virtuous conduct. That is right speech, right action, right livelihood. And I think it's quite significant that the Buddha includes right livelihood here, which shows that he doesn't intend the Noble Eightfold Path exclusively for monastics, but also he's taking into account lay people who earn their living in the world. So in doing so, they have to follow the basic principles, the basic premises of right livelihood, to earn their living in an honest way, a harmless way, a way that involves making a personal effort and not just exploiting others. Okay, so right speech, right action, right livelihood purify our conduct. And then come the three factors which are involved with the cultivation or development of the mind. Actually, the way I understand the Eightfold Path, right effort and right mindfulness will be involved in all of the path factors. You can't develop right action, right speech, without being mindful of one's speech, without being mindful of how one intends to act, and without making an effort to restrain unwholesome types of speech and to restrain unwholesome actions, and making the effort to speak properly, to act properly. So right effort, right mindfulness actually go with all of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, but they become especially important in the process of developing and cultivating the mind in order to attain samadhi or concentration. So it's right effort and right mindfulness. I compare these to like two hands which are working together, cleansing one another in order to gain right concentration. So right effort is the effort to remove unwholesome mental states, to generate and strengthen the wholesome mental states. And then that effort is applied especially to the practice of right mindfulness, the four foundations or four establishings of mindfulness. That is, it's the right effort that gives, it's like the gasoline of the practice, or maybe the electricity in a hybrid. So it's the energy of the practice of mindfulness. And then as mindfulness is being developed in association with this energy, the mindfulness is keeping the object in mind, not letting the mind slip away, not letting the object slip away from the mind, or not letting the mind roam away from the object. And then as the mind focuses in a more and more sustained way on the object, that sustained awareness of the object brings samadhi or concentration. But in the Noble Eightfold Path, when it's developed integrally, right concentration is not the actual conclusion of the Eightfold Path, but rather, once right concentration is achieved, then one has to go back through right mindfulness to investigate the experiences of body and mind. One examines or investigates bodily and mental experience in order to see the true characteristics of one's own body and mind. Or in other words, what we call the five aggregates, the panchakanda, to investigate with the concentrated mind, one investigates the nature of physical form, the nature of feeling, the nature of perception, the nature of volitions, the nature of consciousness, in order to see their true nature. And then when one gains the insight into the conditioned nature of the five aggregates, when one sees them as impermanent, bound up with suffering, non-self, then there comes the higher level of right view. Now this is the right view of experiential insight. It's no longer just conceptual right view, no longer just intellectual understanding, but now one is seeing directly how all of these factors of existence are impermanent, arising and passing. Because they're arising and passing, there's no permanent happiness or security in them. And because they're impermanent and unstable, we cannot take them as a true self, truly enduring self. Okay, so these are the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Maybe I'll ask now whether we have any questions. Was everything so clear that... Or is everybody just a little tired?
You said samadhi is concentration, or is it tranquility?
We usually translate samadhi as concentration, It means the bringing together or collecting of the mind on one object. But together with concentration, the mind becomes tranquil. So we can also say that the mind in samadhi is a tranquil mind. So tranquility exists within samadhi. But I think the distinguishing factor of samadhi is the unification of the mind, the collecting of the mind on its object.
Also, then does it lead to jhanas?
Yeah, sama samadhi is typically defined within the suttas as the four jhanas.
And is the jhana temporary or is it continuous? I mean, when you have the concentration or the samadhi,
yeah.
After that, does it disappear or will it be continuous?
As long as one is sitting in the samadhi, then the jhana will be continuous. But at a certain time, one has to come out. One has to come out from the samadhi, and then one comes out from the jhana. So in that sense, it's not continuous. You know, when the meditator, he might make a determination to, if he's mastered the jhanas, he might determine, I'm going to enter into the fourth jhana for 1 hour. So he'll sit there for 1 hour, but at the end of the 1 hour, then he'll have to get up and go about doing some other things. It's not that when he gets up to go bathing, to go to eat his meal, to take a walk, that he's in jhana on those occasions. Okay, any further questions on this? Okay, then let's go on. Okay, now we're coming to some states of some groups of practices which haven't received very much attention within the continuing, the Theravada tradition. We find them in the suttas, but they're usually not spoken of in any detail in later texts. And it's a little bit unclear exactly what is meant by some of them. Okay, so the first of these is called the Eight Liberations. And now I have to explain here that the word that's translated liberation here, vimoka, doesn't mean liberation in the sense of being liberated from samsara. It's not identical with vimutti, which usually means, especially, a kupa, unshakable liberation. That means complete freedom from birth and death, from samsara. But these are actually states of meditative absorption in which the mind becomes temporarily liberated from certain obstacles, obstructions, or limitations. The word translated is vimoka. And the word that is usually used to designate, we call final or ultimate liberation, is vimutti. Both words come from the same verbal root. And we also get the word used more often in Vedanta or Hinduism. Also, it's from the same root, moksha. It's really, moksha is just the Sanskritized form of Pali moka. And vimoka means intensified or strong liberation. But in the Buddhist texts, vimoka doesn't normally designate final or ultimate liberation, but just a deep state of meditative absorption. Okay, so here the Buddha is speaking. He says, I have proclaimed to my disciples the way to develop the eight liberations. Okay, now come the eight liberations. The first one is, possessed of material form, One sees forms. This is the first liberation. And I'll take the second and then explain these two together. Not perceiving form internally, one sees forms externally. This is the second liberation. Okay, the way these two are explained in the commentary, what is meant by possessed of material form, one sees forms. That's the first liberation. Okay, there are states or objects of meditation that are used for developing samadhi based on colors. One takes a colored object and focuses the mind on that colored object in order to bring the mind into samadhi. Now, what is meant by possessed of material form, one sees forms. So at least this is the way this is, the commentary explains this. One takes the color that one is going to use as a base of meditation from some tissue or organ of the body. For example, to get a blue object of concentration, I don't know whether Indian people have blue eyes. One wouldn't use the iris, but they might take, you know, they say the blue-black color of hair, or maybe a blue, if there's like a black and blue mark, you know, where there's some breaking of the arteries, and the blood turns blue. One gets the blue color from that. One might get the red from the color of blood if one is using a red object. The white, one might take the whites of the eyes, or black from the black of the hair. One might take some other color. One might get white when one sees a piece of bone, so one takes the white of the bone as the object of concentration, and then one takes just that color and uses that color as a base for focusing the mind, and then based on that bodily tissue that one took as the object of concentration, then one will see inwardly some visualized form. And then that form that one sees through mental visualization, that becomes the object of absorption. So that is what is meant by possessed of material form, one sees forms. Okay, the second is not perceiving form internally, one sees form externally. In this case, it said one doesn't take the object, the colored object, from some bodily tissue, but one takes some external colored object as the basis of concentration. For example, to get a blue object, one might take the surface of a pool of water, which is blue. To get the yellow or a blue flower, to get yellow, one might take a yellow flower. To get red, one might take a red flower. Flower makes it easy. The white, one might take, maybe if there's a white dove, the color of the dove, or a white flower. Okay, so one takes some, or a piece of white cloth. So one takes the color from an external object, visualizes it, until one could see the forms with one's inner mental vision. And then one makes that the object of concentration. And then the third liberation, it said one is resolved only upon the beautiful. So what this means is that according to the explanation of the commentary, one takes a very beautiful color and one visualizes that until one gets a very, one develops it, until one gets a very beautiful, very clear, inwardly visualized color as the object of concentration. So, it seems to me that the first three liberations are actually dealing with the four jhanas, or explicating the four jhanas, but where the formula for the four jhanas distinguishes the jhanas by way of the inner subjective state, the factors of mind that are present. These three liberations are explaining or illustrating the objects of the jhanas. So each of them can be the basis for all four jhanas. So one could have four jhanas based on the internal visible form. One could have the four jhanas based upon this external form, and one can have the four jhanas based upon this exceptionally beautiful colored form that one sees. Okay, so those are the first three liberations. The next four are the four called the four formless meditations, the four formless attainments. So the first of these is called the base of the boundlessness of space, or the base of the infinity of space. So here, in order to enter this meditative state, one has to completely overcome all perceptions of form. You see, in the first three liberations, one has a perception of some form. It's a visualized form, but there's still a form there as the object. But now, with the base of infinite space, it says one completely surmounts perceptions of form. Then perceptions of sensory impact disappear. So there's no perception through the impact on the senses, not even on the inner visual sense. Then there's no attention to perception of diversity, of all of the diversified objects of the senses, but instead one is just aware that space is infinite, and so one enters and dwells in the base of the infinity of space. That's the fourth liberation. Then, going beyond infinite space, you see, when one is aware of infinite space, there is a consciousness that's aware of infinite space. And so one can reflect back on that consciousness that's aware of infinite space, and then one becomes aware that consciousness, the range of consciousness, is infinite. So that becomes the base of the infinity of consciousness. Then one could attend to the fact that within that infinite consciousness, there is no impediment, no obstruction. It's like a pure infinity. So that becomes then the base of nothingness. And then going beyond the base of nothingness, one comes to a state which is so subtle that it's said that there's, one could neither say that perception is present nor absent. This is called the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, now it has to be pointed out that all of these states that have been described here, these first seven liberations, are not stages of what we would call realization through wisdom. They're not stages attained through insight, but they are just very deep stages of meditative absorption. The Buddha had practiced these before his enlightenment, and he retained them in his teaching, but he didn't make them mandatory for the attainment of enlightenment. Because they don't let's say that they can be used as a base or a support for developing wisdom, but on their own, they don't imply the presence of wisdom. Okay, the eighth liberation, this is a meditative attainment. It's called the base of, this goes beyond the base of neither perception nor non-perception, and this is called the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling. This is a state in which perception and feeling completely stop, completely end within that attainment. And this is said to be a state. To enter that, one has to bring together samadhi and wisdom. And it's said that this state is accessible only to non-returners and to arahats, not to other people. So this is a state that requires the attainment or requires the development of wisdom. Okay, so these are the eight liberations. Any? I'm going to ask whether there's any questions, but I might have to run out the door if you ask me a hard question. Okay, Richard, you can take the microphone.
What's a base?
Okay, that's a good question. What is meant by a base? Okay, the word here, the Pali word is ayatana. And it's a word that's used very often in the Buddhist texts in different contexts with somewhat different shades of meaning. In reference to these meditative attainments, I would say that the meditative attainment itself is what is being called a base. So it's just the meditative attainment of infinite space, the meditative attainment of infinite consciousness, the meditative attainment of nothingness, and so on.
Ayatana is the stage of enlightenment?
Excuse me?
Ayatana means, what is it? It's stage of what? Enlightenment?
No, it's not a stage of enlightenment. It's... In this passage, I said the ayatana, the base, refers to the meditative attainment itself. So it's just that particular meditative state in which the object is infinite space that's called the base of infinite space. Where the object is infinite consciousness, that is the base of infinite consciousness. Okay, Barbara.
Can you say a little bit more about this awareness that there is nothing? It seems the way it's put here, it seems to go beyond the emptiness teaching. More on what that really means.
Yeah, it's not, the nothing here has no relation to emptiness or shunyata. It's not the same word, and it's not referring to shunyata as the aspect of the absence of intrinsic nature or self-nature. And this is just the way I understand it. And it's my personal understanding. And I say not from direct experience of it. Okay, the text uses the word not. Aware there is nothing, nati kincha. The way I understand it, it doesn't mean that that there's absolutely nothing at all that exists. Not that way. It's not a philosophical statement, but it's a description of the experience within this state. Okay, first the meditator goes into the base of infinite space, then the base of infinite consciousness, Okay, then within the base of infinite consciousness, sort of one reflects back on that state, and one finds that within this infinite consciousness, you know, there's nothing to get a grip on, so to speak, in the sense of that there's no obstruction, but this consciousness just seems to pervade everything infinitely, and there's nothing obstructing it, no impediment, no obstruction to the infinite spread of consciousness. And so then one takes that in the sense that there is nothing here in the sense of impeding or obstructing the movement of that or the extension of that consciousness. And instead of focusing on the infinite consciousness, one just focuses on the absence of any obstruction, and that is the nothingness. It sounds like... Again, I have to say that's my interpretation. So if you meet an advanced yogi who comes out and you ask him about the base of nothingness, you tell him this is what Bhante Bodhi said, and he says, he doesn't know what he's talking about. I might have to agree with him.
I'm really surprised that the commentaries don't bring up Anapanasati in the internal and external form, because the breath is that initial way to meet with internal form, and then that becomes suffusive, and it becomes a means, almost an elementary means for identifying with the external, and that erosion between the two becomes I'm very surprised to hear kasina, color kasina, being the basis of form here at the very outset.
But that's the way they explain it. It's quite possible that, you know, in the original way of practice, maybe mindfulness of breathing was taken to be one of these liberations.
As a form, it seems like Satipatthana and Anapanasati were so emphasized by the Buddha. That form is both internal and external. So.
Yeah, I think there is some truth in it, yeah. Yeah, but it seems within these liberations, so the emphasis is on seeing the forms. So it's the emphasis on getting an internal visualization of form rather than focusing on the breath. Anyway, this is the way they explain it. Okay, I think we'll have to take the break now. We'll take a break for the lunch. And then after lunch, we could come back, say, 12:10. And then we could have some discussion, questions. Again, if somebody wants to get personal instruction for going into the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception or non-perception, I think we could see about getting you a ticket to Burma or... Thailand, Sri Lanka. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, so we share the merits with the devas, the buddhas or fear spirits, the nagas, and with all beings, asking them to protect the Buddha's teaching, to protect the world, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu sasanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparam. Etavatajamehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya Etavatajamehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya Etavatajamehi padam punya sampadam sabbe sadanu modantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya vichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha asanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. Okay, thank you for your attention. So next week we'll have a class, and I'll finish up the sutta next week. And I want to mention also that in 2 weeks from now, there'll be a 3-day meditation retreat here. This will be, I think, Friday, Saturday, maybe 4 days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. This will be a meditation retreat on mindfulness of breathing, aware of anapanasati. So if you're interested to attend that, you can sign up. You'll see notices on some of the bulletin boards about it. And I think you have to contact the monastery by email? What? Or through the office, can they do it?
Just go online.
Go online, yeah. Okay. Okay, so we end with 3 half bows to the Buddha.
Out of bumble.